My name is Joyce Coleman, and I'm here interviewing Marion Namenworth. She was a professor of zoology at UW from 1971 to 1979, and the date is March 27th, 2004. So, Professor Namenworth, perhaps you could begin by telling me a little bit about when and where you were born and a bit about your childhood.
Well, I was born in August of 1939 in New York City. My parents had arrived from Germany 3 years before. They had escaped the Hitler period, or the Hitler persecution in Germany, and were busy working in New York. They had not been able to bring much with them, so they both worked to get some income. And I was an only child. I grew up in New York, was having a very good time, went through the public schools, and was very much taken up with what they were teaching me. I loved school, and then went to the Bronx High School of Science, which was a high school with a competitive entrance exam that was oriented particularly toward science, and I worked hard there and really enjoyed the courses in science and mm-hmm. in other subjects too, but in physics, chemistry, biology. So, and then set my sights on going to college.
Okay, if I could just interrupt for a second, how would you become interested in science?
That's a very good question. Well, the first sign that I was would become devoted to biology was that I was just nuts about animals mm-hmm. As a child, and I collected animals from wherever I could. I mean, that would include the pet shop, and when going to the country in the summer, I would collect salamanders and frogs, and as much as possible, I would bring these animals home into my room in the little apartment in New York City where I lived, and care for them, and sometimes re-release them into the wild if they survived for another season. Mm-hmm. And I was very, very focused on animals. So in school, when in junior high school, science was a particular class subject, I loved it. I was really drawn to it, and I was crazy about my science teacher, Miss Monks, and I was completely absorbed by the science class and also by math classes. I think math and science were my favorites at that time.
Mm-hmm.
There's also the fact that being Jewish and with my entire extended family having had to escape to another country recently, the family was very oriented towards educating children to have an independent profession
mm-hmm.
and with which they could support themselves, and preferably a profession that you could take with you from country to country.
Mm-hmm.
And so seeing that I was really interested in biology and science, they pushed me to going to medical school and becoming a physician.
Okay.
And that seemed all right. So I aimed towards preparing myself for medical school, although the more science I took, for example, in high school, the more interested I was in science as a more theoretical subject, and particularly biology and biochemistry, rather than medical school. But the background coursework that you would take for medical school or for graduate school in science were more or less the same, and so I didn't have to make a choice, and,
mm-hmm.
and so I decided to take the curriculum that would prepare me for both these endeavors and choose later.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, I decided to that I prefer an academic career
okay.
in science.
Okay, and now how did you choose a college for your undergraduate studies?
It was difficult. It was very competitive at that time, getting into schools near New York City, from New York City, and particularly so from schools like the High School of Science, where practically everybody applied to college, and many of them in or around New York City. So among the colleges that I applied to was Cornell University. My family got advice from an American friend who was an educator who knew the colleges somewhat. I applied to Pembroke and Cornell and some other school, I don't know what. And I actually, though I applied to the Arts and Sciences School at Cornell, I didn't get in, but it was easier to get into the Agriculture School at Cornell, and it had the same courses in mm-hmm. your first 2 years, certainly, as you would take in the art school. In fact, they were, you took the same exact courses. So I went to Cornell, and I started in the Agriculture School with the intention of switching to the Arts and Sciences College my junior year so that I could take the curriculum that I wanted.
Mm-hmm.
As it turned out, so many people were doing this that the school had made arrangements where you had to pay years of back tuition. See, the agriculture school was tuition free.
Oh, okay.
And you had to pay years of back tuition if you wanted to transfer, and I decided that wasn't worthwhile. So I ended up, after finishing 2 years at Cornell, transferring to City College in New York, which was tuition free, with the intention of finishing there.
Mm-hmm.
But then after a year there, I got married, and my husband was a graduate student in music at the University of Minnesota, so I transferred to the University of Minnesota to finish my bachelor's degree.
Okay. Now it sort of sounds clear that zoology was a passion all along, so was it that an easy choice of a major?
Yes, it was, and I should say that I was very interested in these courses, but I was always also very interested in art history, anthropology, and the various courses of that sort that my literature, that my undergraduate friends were taking, and I audited numerous courses and talked with them and so forth. And I think that the greatest enthusiasm in undergraduate school that I had was really for these kinds of courses, like history and government, and particularly art history and philosophy and so forth,
mm-hmm.
which I was tasting as a dilettante, and,
mm-hmm.
and also literature courses, which I just loved. But determination and my honest inclination and desire to be a biologist never was threatened. I never considered going into these other fields. But even though they seemed much more exciting to me to take in the form of coursework, but whereas the courses in biology, chemistry, so forth, they were interesting, but they seemed sort of like more like shop courses. I mean,
mm-hmm.
I felt like I was getting the training I needed, and I was definitely interested in them, but my passions were aroused by the literature and art history and
mm-hmm.
and so anthropology and so forth. And looking back on this phenomenon, it's kind of curious. But anyway, it was not at all a threat to my interest in biology. It's not that anyone was pushing me in that direction at all. It's just that that's where my interest was.
Okay, so you think your parents would have been accepting if you had announced that you wanted to switch to literature, for example?
Well, they would have been concerned at first, asking me would I be able to support myself
mm-hmm.
economically that way. That was their main concern, and since they were immigrants, they didn't have too clear an idea about what the breadwinning aspects
yeah.
of academic careers were.
Yeah.
Now, of course, this was the late 50s, and academe in the United States was expanding a lot, so it looked at that time as though it would not be difficult to have an economically viable career in any one of a large number of fields of academe.
Okay, now you mentioned that this was the late 50s. Was there a certain amount of pressure, I mean, maybe outside of your family, but just from television and from people at school, was there some sort of pressure for women to stay home or to think about studying more traditional female areas?
Well, there was the... let me say several things about that. First of all, well, I have always, or at least since I've been an adult, I've been amazed by the ability of the human brain to simultaneously believe in completely contradictory things.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been part of this. So Anyway, as I grew up, one of the more salient facts of life in my eyes was that women were as important and energetic and important and able economically as men are, because my mother was the dominant figure in the family. Mm-hmm. She was very energetic. She was a very successful businesswoman for that time. And I don't mean that she rose extremely high, but, you know, in the small world in which we lived, mm-hmm. she did. And she was obviously excellent at her work, which was as a saleswoman of women's hats and a representative of a hat company, mm-hmm. you know, running its offices in New York. And so she was very bright and aggressive, and so it never occurred to me that women were less than men in any arena.
Mm-hmm.
Even when I saw that all around me, I'd see it depicted on television, and, you know, I mean, I sort of heard what was going on in the society as I grew up in the 40s and 50s, but it didn't really take, because of the obvious counterexample of my mother.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a few instances where there was bald discrimination lowered on me that I didn't even know about. For instance, I was told later by my family that the guidance counselor in junior high school, when I told her I was interested in science, told my parents or wrote a note to my parents saying that I should go into domestic science.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't even know about that. Maybe I didn't know what domestic science was.
Mm-hmm.
There was also the factor, for instance, that my mother was dismayed when I wanted to go to the High School of Science. She thought that I should go to the High School for Arts,
mm.
and the High School of Music and Art. And even though I'm sure I wouldn't have gotten in, I really didn't have the talent for it. Clearly, that was an example. She repeated this many times, an example of her having internalized the idea that, arts were something that girls should do,
mm-hmm.
And science was not really something mm-hmm. for girls.
Yeah.
I brushed it aside and insisted, and so, you know, when I got into the High School of Science, so, you know, this didn't, you know, it subsided as a problem.
Mm-hmm.
However, one instance of having completely, really absorbed a kind of double standard in this respect that I remember is that there was a fellow student who I knew from high school and then encountered again at City College. She had been in the High School of Science, and when I got to City College, she was majoring in engineering.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember thinking that was very peculiar, that mm-hmm. engineering was not something that a woman did. That was a man's thing. And this seemed totally obvious to me,
mm-hmm.
and I was amazed at what she was doing. And, even though I never for a moment, I wouldn't have questioned myself, I don't think, if I wanted to go into physics, but I preferred biology. But anyway, I had this very strong feeling about engineering. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, got to me a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. Now, are there any outstanding memories you have of your undergraduate degree at these three institutions?
I've mentioned my devotion to literature and art history and these things, which I was getting my first major taste of
mm-hmm.
as an undergraduate. I really enjoyed Cornell University. I worked on the student paper and had many friends who were majoring in philosophy and literature and so forth, and I learned an awful lot about what life had to offer. I was pretty bored at City College. I found it very high schoolish and pedestrian.
Mm-hmm.
in the science courses that I was taking. I took almost exclusively science courses at the time. I found I was interested in them, but it seemed very simple.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got to the University of Minnesota, it was now my senior year, and I was able to take graduate courses which emphasized actual research results,
mm-hmm.
you know, instead of having lectures on you know, that were kind of pre-digested.
Mm-hmm.
I chose courses that consisted of reading actual research papers and discussing those in class, and that I found totally intriguing, so I took a number of courses in genetics and embryology at the University of Minnesota, which were graduate courses that admitted advanced undergraduates, and got more of a close-up feel for what research would be like by reading actual accounts of research,
mm-hmm.
and that really whetted my appetite for graduate school.
Was there anybody at Minnesota who was encouraging you to consider graduate school?
No, I don't remember having conversations of that kind. It was kind of like everything else. I mean, I never doubted that I would go to graduate school and get a PhD. And I later found out that my father doubted it after I got married. He thought once I got married that then I would drop that idea, but it never occurred to me.
Mm-hmm.
And no.
So then when you graduated, you had your heart set on graduate school at that point?
Yes. Actually, when I graduated, it was around the time that my husband passed his prelims in musicology, and we were going to go to Europe for a couple of years, and he was going to do his thesis research there. So we did that. We took off for Holland and Italy and a number of, you know, we moved around a little bit. But mostly we were living in Holland and in Italy. And so I had two glorious years of doing what I wanted. I did not attempt to go to school there. I think I had taken the graduate record exams before I left.
Okay.
But, you know, and my intention was to apply while I was in Europe to graduate school in the United States, which I did. And I remember that a large consideration of what graduate school to choose was one that also had a good music school,
mm-hmm.
so that my husband could perhaps get a job there or something
okay.
like that.
Okay. So then is that what led you to pick Indiana University?
Yes.
Okay.
In other words, it had an excellent program in biology, but also had an excellent music school.
Okay. And what courses and instructors stand out in your mind from your graduate years at Indiana?
Well, when I first applied there, my intention was to study genetics with Dr. Muller, and who, you know, was a Nobel Prize winner, H.J. Muller, and I didn't realize that he was not taking students anymore. You know, he was around retirement at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So, and of course, with the intervening 2 years in Europe, more time elapsed. So I didn't realize when I applied there that I would not be able to study genetics with him. But when I got there, there was the very excellent geneticist, Tracy Sonneborn.
Mm-hmm.
And I also began to take classes from Robert Briggs, who was an experimental embryologist, and when I began, you know, taking a class with him, I realized that he was very much focused on the genetic aspects of embryonic development, how genes function as organisms develop,
mm-hmm.
and he was also very oriented towards actual research and focusing on lab data, and had much less interest in theoretical questions, and you know, was very focused on the evidentiary aspects of science and remembering what's been demonstrated and what hasn't.
Mm-hmm.
So that all appealed to me. You know, I liked him a lot as a person, and he seemed very bright, and his interests coincided with mine. So I ended up asking to work with him, and I, you know, really learned a lot from him, though I also took courses from Tracy Sonneborn, and that was challenging, and I took, and very interesting. He's a very interesting teacher, and also I learned my first bits of molecular biology and biochemistry taking courses in those fields.
Okay. Were there any women doing developmental genetics or biochemistry there? I mean, either faculty or graduate students?
Well, there were plenty of women graduate students. I think, you know, about half the graduate students in genetics and in embryonic development, at least half were women. As far as women faculty, I remember a visiting woman faculty member who I took a course from in ultraviolet biology, you know, the effects of UV radiation on biological systems. Mm-hmm. I don't remember any regular women faculty, but I might just be forgetting. However, at that time, it, you know, the better school, the so-called better schools, I mean the ones with the excellent reputations, had very few women faculty, if any, mm-hmm. in their science departments, and it may have been less asymmetric in liberal arts, but in the sciences, there were not many women in the schools with the bigger reputations, and, you know, that was just the way it was.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever feel that women graduate students were treated differently than men graduate students?
It depends. I mean, first of all, even with somebody like Robert Briggs, the person I work for, who had about half women and who seemed to me, in general, treated women reasonably, even with him, there were some indications that men and women were not considered exactly the same. For one thing, traditionally in some fields like cell biology and embryonic development, women students tended to gravitate to those fields. Mm-hmm. And I know that Briggs was concerned not to get into a situation where there were more women than men in his graduate group.
Mm.
He felt that that would be a threat to the well-being or being taken seriously or something of his graduate group. So he was concerned about that. Then there was a fact which at the time seemed totally reasonable to me. When I asked to be a student working in his group, you know, we had a little interview, and he asked me whether I was planning to have children, and if so, then what was going to happen to my graduate career. And I answered him that, you know, I planned to continue my career, and I didn't see any problem with that, with having a family and a research career, and that I was devoted to research. And he was satisfied, and I was satisfied. That seemed a totally mm-hmm. reasonable question to me at the time. Even though if I'd thought about it, I would have realized that men were all having children, and many of them were married, and they were not being asked this question.
Mm-hmm.
But even if I'd made that conscious, I think it would still seem totally reasonable to me.
Okay.
So.
Okay.
I think that I think the phenomenon probably existed. I'd heard about it in theory. I'm not so sure I saw evidence of it. That faculty sponsors were more concerned about the viability of men's careers. So, for example, in pushing them towards particular research topics, they were more likely to saddle women with topics that might not yield in the short run, or, you know, that the things that were worth doing that the professor wanted done, but which probably wouldn't have a splashy result and which would therefore make it harder for them to get a good job, whereas they would be more protective of men's long-term interests in such selections.
Okay. Was this something you noticed at the time, or is this something you noticed in retrospect?
I think it was more in the air. I don't, you know, in other words, something that people were conscious of or concerned about or something, or maybe later in my graduate career. I don't, it certainly was, there was no such problem in Briggs's lab. One factor is that he, in contrast to other faculty member, he encouraged students to choose their own research questions.
Okay.
And I chose my own. So it, you know, however, in this was very unusual. In most labs, the professor pretty much handed a problem to a graduate student, and there, of course, it can be more of a problem. Mm-hmm. I think I might have heard about this more later, you know, in the 70s when I was a faculty member, and questions of equity for women were more openly and self-consciously discussed.
Okay. Now, is there anything else you want to say about your PhD program, or do you want to talk about your postdoctoral work now?
I guess we could go on to the postdoctoral work. I hope you don't mind if I think of things later.
We can certainly go back. Yeah, I guess I haven't really asked you yet the topic of your dissertation, and maybe that's important to know.
I chose to work on limb regeneration in salamanders, and particularly on the question of whether the cells that engage in regeneration, whether they undergo changes of cell differentiation, like muscle becoming cartilage or something like that, at the cellular level, whether a cell that had been differentiated as a cartilage cell whether its progeny would always still be cartilage cells when a limb regenerated, or whether there could be changes of cell type, so the progeny of a cartilage cell might become a skin cell or a muscle cell or something like that. And I studied this with using triploidy, having three sets of chromosomes rather than two, using that as a genetic marker, and grafting tissues from triploid animals into regular diploid animals, and then looking at the results after regeneration.
Okay.
So I did extensive experiments, and they were well received, and, you know, eventually the stuff was published, and I also reported at meetings, and it was considered, you know, of real interest at the time.
Okay. And how did you come across that topic?
It was one of the topics we studied in Briggs's experimental embryology seminar. I mean, studied in the sense of read papers that people had published about this. This is of interest because the most prominent researcher in the area at the time was a woman at Harvard Medical School, Elizabeth Hay, and she did excellent work in this field, was very much respected, and so it was immediately, even though I didn't separate it as a category in my mind consciously, it is a case where it was obvious to me that a woman had done excellent work and in this field. Now, I would say also that there were several prominent women in the intersection of genetics and embryonic development, and also in genetics itself, of course. And in both my, for instance, Barbara McClintock, after a long time, she got a Nobel Prize, but
yes.
she was a very prominent geneticist, and I should say that even in my undergraduate career at Cornell, now she had been at Cornell, although I don't remember that was made prominent, but she figured very prominently in my undergraduate education. I mean, her results were reported as very important and described at length.
Mm-hmm.
And despite, you know, let's say at Cornell at the time, there were probably, I can't remember a single woman faculty member in biology, in the biological departments, or in chemistry or anything, but nobody seemed to slight the importance of Barbara McClintock's work.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, she and Elizabeth Hay and Beatrice Mintz were examples of women whose work was treated with great interest and respect. Beatrice Mintz had worked with Bob Briggs, my major professor, at a previous institution and at the K Cancer Research Institute in Fox Chase, Pennsylvania. And so he knew her work very well, and anyway, her work was important. So she was also a person whose work was presented at length, and there seemed to be no hesitation or anything special about the fact that these were women who were doing excellent science until they applied for faculty positions.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying they applied at Indiana, but, you know, in fact, these more major institutions were not admitting women to the tenured faculty on the whole in the science departments.
Okay. But it sounds like these three women in some ways were like role models to you.
Well, I wasn't conscious of it because there was no question in my mind as to whether women could do good work in this field. I just wasn't bright enough to think about it.
Mm.
It just seemed, I just never questioned it.
Okay.
But maybe unconsciously it was reassuring. You know, it was never a question in my mind at all. It should have been, but it wasn't.
Hmm. Okay. Now, did you continue doing similar research for your postdoctoral work?
No. I already at the end of my graduate period, I got interested in something somewhat different that has to do with the molecular architecture of eggs, and I was trying to think of ways to divide eggs into different regions because the different regions develop in different directions. Like one region becomes the brain, and one region becomes the digestive tract, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And I was interested in what molecules were initiating these different directions of differentiation. So I wanted to focus on that for a postdoc, and I purposely applied for a postdoc in biochemistry because I felt I needed more experience in that line. And excuse me a minute. And so I was accepted at in the biochemistry department at the University of Seattle to work with Brian McCarthy, who was a nucleic acid biochemist, and I proposed a study of the different regions of the frog egg, trying to determine what molecules were important in getting differentiation going in different directions very early.
Okay. And what kind of an experience did you have at the University of Seattle?
It's the University of Washington in Seattle, and it was very informative. This was a large lab with many postdoctoral students. Brian McCarthy spent much of his time traveling around the country giving talks and examining grants on peer review panels and so forth. He was not so often in the laboratory. But there were very good postdocs there, and I learned a lot from them. They were from, you know, different countries, and they had a lot of experience in biochemistry. Of course, I worked a little with Brian McCarthy himself, but mostly I learned from the other postdocs, and I tried techniques that I had never had any laboratory experience with. And I learned a lot.
Hmm. So it was generally a positive experience then?
Oh, definitely.
And then you finished that in 1971. What was the job market like at that point for people with your training?
It was fabulous. And the reason was that I happened to appear on the job market at the moment when Congress was lowering the boom on the major universities, telling them that they had to add women to all their faculties.
Yes.
And so I was inundated with job offers. It was totally, it was totally over the top in the sense of all of a sudden, for a brief period, or maybe not so brief, but it was just the beginning of this period of the major schools really coming under pressure.
Okay.
So I had a series of offers, and I chose the University of Wisconsin.
Okay, and maybe you could just clarify. Now, this was 1971, and yet federal impact, like the Equal Opportunities Act, or Equal Employment Opportunities Act and Title IX are both passed in 1972. But then you're saying before 1972 there was still interest?
Yeah, I think, I presume that there was a lot of talk about this in Congress, and probably universities were asked to send representatives to testify and so forth about whether this should come to pass. You know, I wasn't paying much attention to what was going on in the government at the time, but, you know, it was sort of generally known in, you know, the front section of science and nature. There's a lot of chit-chat about what's going on in government and so forth, and I think this, you know, Congress didn't just pass something out of the blue. I mean, there's always a period before where there's wrangling about it, and I guess that the major schools knew that, you know, this was coming down.
Okay.
And then also, they were challenged now. I mean, you know, the women's movement was gathering force, and it was embarrassing, you know, to not have women on you know, large numbers of departments. And, you know, especially, I mean, because a lot of these things happened by sort of gentlemen's agreements. They would, you know, I think before people were not sitting in faculty meetings saying we can't afford to have a woman on the faculty, there was just a kind of understanding that that was not going to help the reputation of the school, and, you know, women were diverted by their family chores, and that it was just unwise you know, take a woman applicant so seriously.
Okay. Now, you mentioned the women's movement. Up until this point, had you had any involvement or any interest in the women's movement? Did you know very much about it?
No, nothing.
Okay.
In fact, I remember during my postdoc period, I drove down to California to visit a friend, and a friend from way back, and we drove around one day for fun around Carmel, and I remember sitting in the car, and the car's going round and round. She was driving, and she began talking about NOW, and I had no idea what it was. And she told me it was the National Organization for Women, and I told her I'd never heard of it, and she could hardly believe it. And, you know, so no, I knew nothing about it.
Okay.
That was like 1970.
Okay. Now, why did you accept UW's offer over all of the other offers you received?
It had a very large and very good biology research establishment, which was spread over a very large number of departments, a few of them in the arts school, but in the arts and sciences college, but, you know, there was the whole agriculture school and the whole medical school. All of them had departments devoted to various aspects of biology, genetics, biochemistry, and so forth. And so altogether, there were a very large number of researchers who, many of whom did excellent work, with, you know, that I knew of. And then also the school had a lot of internal research funds that they allocated to support researchers, including especially new people coming in. So they were offering superb facilities and a lot of startup money, and it just seemed an excellent opportunity.
Okay.
And you know, in a place where I'd be happy to live and so on. But I had offers from other good places. And, you know, Amherst was one of that I remember, and Austin, you know, University of Texas.
Do you remember who recruited you, who the chair of the department was, and how the recruitment process worked?
I don't know really what was going on before I came as far as recruitment. I think that Robert Auerbach had a lot to do with arranging for me to be interviewed, for me to be considered, and he was a developmental biologist, and I don't know what the politics of it were, I don't know really what was going on in the department at the time, and what it meant, you know, if I was competing against other people for this position, I really don't know.
Okay. Now, so you get to UW in 1971. I was wondering if you could just talk a little bit about the situation of women in the sciences on campus. Just where were the women? What types of positions did they have? Where were there no women? That sort of thing.
Could we stop a minute?
Absolutely, yes. Now, you were just going to talk a little bit about the situation of the women in, of women in the sciences when you came to UW in 1971.
Yes, there were hardly any. I can't think of a single woman faculty member in the who was in a tenured position in a science department that I interacted with. Now, undoubtedly, there were. I would say, for instance, Lorraine Meisner was in such a position,
mm-hmm.
And that was in the agriculture school in a. I think, whatever school it was, whatever college it was like state hygiene department or something
yes,
like that.
Yes.
I don't remember exactly, but she definitely had a secure and important position. But, you know, in botany, zoology, and as far as I know, chemistry and physics and so forth, I didn't know of any women in tenured positions, or I don't recall them now. Certainly not in the zoology department where I was hired. Now, there had been a woman professor. She was promoted to professor in her last year on the faculty, but she'd been an associate professor for many years before that. Her name was Nellie Bilstead
mm-hmm.
in zoology. I think I might have met her at retirement parties or for other people or something like that, maybe. I'm not sure I met her in life. But I did hear occasionally that Nellie Bilstead had existed. She had taught histology and sort of cell biology kind of courses, primarily histology. And as far as I was told, she did not do research. She did just teaching. She seemed to be the only woman who had ever been on the tenured faculty or in a tenure-track position. There were a number of women working at non-tenure track positions in the department when I came. There was Marion Meyer, who was a lecturer and who also, you know, taught and did not do research.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, as the women's movement heated up after, you know, around the mid-70s, she was moved to a tenured or tenure track position. I don't know whether she first became an assistant professor, then, you know, being moved from the non-tenure track to the tenure track, or whether she was, I don't remember. But anyway, she received a secure position in the tenure part as a result of the women's movement.
Okay.
And there were also women who were project associates, postdoctoral fellows, and many of them had been there many years, but also like Helen Meyer was a senior scientist, but these were not tenured positions. They were, or tenure track, they were research positions that were, you know, that didn't have that kind of security and also didn't have that kind of influence in the department. You know, if you are a tenure track faculty person, you engage in faculty meetings and you have some influence on the policies of the department, and that was not true of anyone who was not in tenure track.
Okay. Did you feel at all out of place, or did this bother you that there were so few women in tenure track positions?
Well, it seemed like, you know, as I mentioned, I realized that I was coming into the faculty system at a moment when it had been open to women for the first time, so I, you know, knew that this was an unusual situation and that things would change. But I fully expected the system to open up, that I would be followed by many other women who would gain access to tenure-track positions. And in fact, of course, that happened. It didn't happen smoothly, but,
mm-hmm.
you know, over 10, 20 years, women have been able to get tenured track and tenured positions at major universities, and the situation is different now. It's not perfect, and, you know, a lot of women have been forced out in the process. There was a lot of discrimination and discomfort, but, you know, over time, things have changed.
Okay. And you attribute a lot of this to the women's movement and to federal legislation as well.
Yes.
Do you remember the impact of federal legislation? I mean, you said before even the legislation was passed, universities started to be concerned about the number of women on their faculties and to try to hire more women. Do you remember what happened after the legislation, if there were particular committees or particular administrators? What sorts of specific actions came out of that legislation?
I think that the schools came under pressure to achieve numerical goals in the admission of women to the tenure track faculty, and in the first few years, these goals had to do with having a certain percentage of women among the newly recruited assistant professors, people in tenure track who could be promoted to tenured positions, but were initially in at the assistant professor ranks,
mm-hmm.
and then in the later 70s there were goals for the rate of promotion, and so every year or two the university would publish tables that purported to show the what proportion of each rank of the faculty were women now, and what proportion of women versus men were being promoted, and progress was extremely slow.
Mm-hmm.
There was also there were statistics about what proportion of the eligible candidate pool for each position were women, and there was pressure for universities to interview at least one woman for every a new position, and you know, of course, there was a lot of window dressing with this. I mean, some of the time women were brought in who were not serious candidates just so that they could say that a woman had been interviewed. There certainly was resistance. And also, you know, there were women who left, you know, who were hired and then left before they were promoted because they didn't feel comfortable in the situation, in departments and so forth. But the effect of the legislation was to keep the pressure up for performance on these goals. And I think that the entry of women into the higher ranks of the university would have been even... into the associate professor and professor ranks at the university was exceedingly slow. The rates of promotion were very slow, and they were not hiring women directly into the higher ranks on the whole. So throughout the period that I was at Wisconsin, women were concentrated in the lowest ranks of the tenure track, and also they continued to be a large proportion of the non-tenured faculty, the people who were helping with the, who were teaching specialists of and research specialists of different kinds.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think that progress was so slow?
I think that there was discrimination involved. Let me focus on Wisconsin. You know, of course, the situation varies, you know, from department to department, but in the zoology department, for example, I didn't expect any discrimination at all against women. These people seem to me to be very reasonable and kind of liberal, progressive types on the whole, and well-meaning, and the whole idea of discrimination was silly, and they thought it was silly, and, you know, that they thought of themselves as entirely focused on the quality of research. research and teaching and the quality of thinking, and I agreed. So I didn't expect when I went there to see any signs of discrimination at all. But as I was there and saw the way that the tenure system worked in practice, I mean the way the system worked of treating people and giving them opportunities before tenure and then evaluating them for tenure, it was obvious to me that it was not even-handed, comparing the way women and men were treated. And I think to a considerable extent this was unconscious on the part of the faculty in their decisions. I think they believed in what they were doing. But, you know, this was, as time passed, women and society in general became conscious of a lot of ways that biased decisions are made that are not exactly intentional.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, for let's say an example in the zoology department would be that the only experience they'd had with a woman on the tenured faculty was a woman who was doing just teaching and not research, and my impression was that's the way they wanted it, and that's what they thought of in terms of women, that women were service personnel who got the teaching done. What was really valued in the biology departments at the University of Wisconsin was research, not teaching. I mean, it was important to get the teaching done, and they gave lip service to the quality of teaching, and some of the teaching done there, much of the teaching was of very high quality, but whether it was or it wasn't, that wasn't the important factor in deciding whether you got tenure. It was really research, and they would, you know, they would load me up, you know, their debut woman of that period, with, you know, a lot of teaching, and you know, when it came time to you know, allocate time either to teaching or research, they sort of kept the pressure on for the teaching and were kind of stingy in providing the kinds of opportunities for research time that they routinely offered men. So, you know, that would be an example of biased decision making.
Okay, it almost sounds like there was a sort of I'm not sure if I'm understanding correctly, but there was sort of a simple idea of discrimination, sort of not giving somebody a job, that's discrimination, but perhaps less understanding of the very subtle ways in which discrimination can take place?
Yes, I think it just wasn't thought about, and you know, some of these things you had to see it in action to understand it. For example, one thing that I learned, one thing that was extremely helpful and was an example of the openness of the department, of the zoology department, was that when I first came there in 71, they had decided that that the faculty discussions when somebody was considered for tenure were going to be open to all the faculty, including the non-tenured faculty.
Mm-hmm.
So as a result, I was able to sit in on the discussions for the whether two or three of the men ahead of me would become tenured. And from sitting in on those discussions, I got an idea about how the tenure considerations worked. Excuse me a minute. About how the, you know, what sorts of questions were debated in deciding whether to recommend tenure for an assistant professor.
Mm-hmm.
And what I saw was that one faculty member would take responsibility for shepherding the case through the faculty. You know, that person would carefully examine the record of the candidate and presumably to have talked with them and have some idea about their strengths and weaknesses. And then that professor, of course the candidate was not in the room, but
mm-hmm.
That professor would present that person's case to the rest of the faculty and kind of act as his lawyer, you know, acting on his behalf,
mm-hmm.
and kind of defending him, or at least, you know, trying to explain explain the weaknesses and give a lot of attention to the strengths.
Yeah.
Now, when I came up for tenure, nobody was willing to take that position.
Hmm.
And part of the problem, and you know, having heard about this in the situations of other people too, I think part of the problem was that there was something sociologically embarrassing about taking up the cause of a woman.
Okay.
And so a problem was created in the structure of the way the tenure system was to work. And what was problematic about it was that there was no rule in the university that said one person shall act as the defender or lawyer or representative of the candidate. This is something that had developed informally,
mm-hmm.
so that when nobody wanted to do it for a woman, nobody realized that this would, they weren't even so conscious that that's what usually happens, or
yeah.
that if it didn't happen for a woman, that this would create a problem in itself.
Yeah.
You know, so that's an example of one of the things which by the end of the 70s was, you know, a paradigmatic situation that universities realized they had to step in and deal with.
Okay.
And there were many things like that, including, for instance, the tendency to give women a whole lot of teaching to do and then ask why they weren't doing so much research.
Okay.
There were many things like that that were sort of, you know, not exactly planned,
okay.
but they ended up in biased decisions.
Okay. Now, at what point did you become involved with the women's movement on campus? I mean, can you talk a little bit about how the women's movement came to campus and your role in it?
Well, I don't remember exactly how I learned that there was an organization forming called the Association of Faculty Women, but I learned about it. Maybe it was just an announcement sent around, or I don't know. But I went, and I was... I went to a meeting, and I was very impressed by the women I met there. You know, one of them, and one of the prominent ones, was Ruth Blyer
mm-hmm.
from the neurophysiology department.
Yes.
They were virtually entirely... Excuse me a minute, I have to cough.
Yes.
They were almost entirely women from other departments. I think that one of the postdocs... in the department, Gabrielle Cass. I think she might have told me about the Association of Faculty Women. I think we went together at any rate, went over there together. But there were almost no women who I had known before, and so I met other women in other departments, and they seemed like dynamic and interesting people, so I was very interested in it, and they took an activist role in trying to create, take actions that would push the university towards admitting women to higher positions at a more rapid rate. So I continued to go to the meetings and work with them.
Okay, and who, apart from Ruth Blyer, do you remember any of the other leaders of the AFW?
I think that at the beginning that Serena Pondrum participated.
Mm-hmm.
She then, perhaps already at that time or soon after, took on some kind of administrative post in the university. I don't remember who. I think there were both women faculty, but also a lot of women who were in, you know, research positions or non-tenure track positions.
Okay.
And, you know, it certainly wasn't representative of the women on campus. I mean, many women didn't come or came only briefly. I don't remember whether, for instance, whether Lorraine Meisner was there or I'm sorry, I don't remember.
Oh, that's okay. It was a while ago.
Yeah.
But it sounds like it was very meaningful for you just to start connecting with other women on campus.
Yes, definitely.
Now, did you start talking to them? I mean, what sorts of... Would you talk about experiences you were each having in your own laboratories, or was it more about sort of public agitation, more activism?
It was more in that direction, but there was some discussion about, you know, problems people were having at work and how to deal with them, and, you know, that the universities, what had been set up within the administration to assist women was really not... worthwhile. It was not functional because, you know, these offices with representatives for women's advancement really owed their allegiance to the administration and were really, their objective was to prevent a scandal, not to help individual women, even though that's not what they said publicly, but people who tried to go to these offices with affirmative action offices with complaints or with requests for help, the kind of help they would get was not necessarily in the interests of the plaintiff, but, you know, had to do with smoothing things over for the administration.
Okay. Now, did talking to all these women and meeting them, did that change your perspective about your own situation? Did you start to see things differently?
Well, I guess it was certainly nice to feel that I had, you know, that there was the potential for support there, but I was completely lulled into a you know, through most of the 70s, I mean, until I came, you know, was rejected for tenure, I had been lulled into the feeling that things were very above board in that respect in the zoology department. For example, I realized that I was getting more pressure to do more teaching than the men were, but I expected that would be considered when they considered me for tenure, that, you know, since they had loaded all this teaching on me, that they would realize that takes time and that, you know, the research articles that I published in that period would have to be balanced against, you know, what my teaching obligations were. It wasn't just there was also the phenomenon, and this is another one of these things that at this time universities had not realized they had to deal with, that if you are one of the few women on tenure track on the campus, in especially in science departments, that and if the school is under pressure to have women in positions of power, then you are asked to sit on a gazillion committees,
mm-hmm.
so that there will be a woman on the committee. And this happened to me too. And, you know, being not too, having, you know, not much insight into the situation, I agreed to do a whole lot of administrative work, you know, quite a bit more than men were expected to do. You know, thinking that yes, it was important to have women on these various committees, and, you know, assuming that this would be taken into account in a reasonable way when,
mm-hmm.
at the time of tenure evaluation, but, you know, it wasn't. So, and this is a widespread phenomenon. So, I had been completely lulled by the fairness and even generosity that I had seen in the consideration of other assistant professors for tenure in the zoology department, which happened to be men, but I, you know, all of them, that's all there were. I'd been lulled into thinking that, you know, they would be even-handed and reasonable in evaluating my record, but, and so, when you say, did I feel I could lean on the Association of Faculty Women for backing, I wasn't really expecting to need backing.
Okay, yeah.
Until, you know, late in the game.
Okay, and yes, we certainly will come back to the tenure issue a bit later on. Now, I guess when you say, can you give some, I know this was a while ago, do you remember specific examples of what the Association of Faculty Women was doing? Were they trying to create particular positions or certain committees? Do you remember just sort of some examples of how they didn't accept what the university was doing already and were, they were pushing for more?
We would analyze the reports and tables that were produced by the administration to which they used to demonstrate to the government and the public, I guess, that they were active in affirmative action, that they actually were trying to recruit and promote women. And we would point out that very little progress was being made, and a lot of women who were hired were leaving, you know, while they were still assistant professors, and that numerous women were being rejected for tenure, and that even though, you know, 5 or 10 years had gone by during which these efforts were supposed to have been in force, yet still, you know, the percentage of women among the full professors was minuscule, and there were very few women among the associate professors, and the women that they were all crowded in the assistant professor ranks, and that this wasn't, or among instructors, and that this was hardly changing, and that at this rate it would take until, you know, several centuries to get to equity. And so the Association of Faculty Women was issuing statements and, you know, having not exactly press conferences, but placing articles in newspapers, and sometimes there were demonstrations, or I think there was an activist movement that had to do with obtaining locker room space for women. There was something about
In athletics, I've heard something similar to that. Yes.
But most of it was, you know, had to do with criticizing the rate at which women were being admitted to the higher positions in the faculty, and questioning the true motives of the administration and so forth.
Okay, so a lot of what you were doing was countering the official information that was coming from the university.
Yes.
Okay. Do you know how the university viewed the Association of Faculty Women? Presumably.
Before, let me just add one other thing. I think there was a discussion, and I don't remember to what extent this happened, of trying to develop sort of like sponsorships for women, in the sense of that there was an effort to link new women faculty with experienced women faculty,
like a mentorship,
so that they could, you know, so they could have a coach who knew something about the way the university worked.
So like a mentorship program then.
Anyway, in answer to your, could you repeat your question?
I was just wondering how the university viewed the AFW, how it treated it, what the attitude of faculty members and administrators was towards the association.
I think that it was, an antagonistic relationship. They considered them an sort of a nuisance lobbying group, and I think that the Association of Faculty Women was considered to be radical, or to be dominated by radical women, and so in that sense, I suppose that it, to the extent that people, faculty in zoology, knew that I was attending those meetings or interacting with them, you know, it might have raised some eyebrows, but nobody ever, but I don't know, you know, I think the attitudes of the faculty varied. I doubt that too many faculty lost any sleep over it.
Okay. Do you know of any women who perhaps didn't agree with the Association of Faculty Women, who perhaps found the organization too radical?
Know of individual faculty who felt that way?
I'm wondering about the women on campus, if there were some who strongly...
I think so. There, a few of the people in there were considered radical and over the top by some others. There was a woman who was in educational...
Joan Roberts, perhaps?
Administration or something?
Yeah, I think her name might be Joan Roberts.
Yeah, that's it. She's an example of somebody who was very vociferous and who did some strident things, I guess, although I can't remember what they are, but I think she would be an example of somebody who was considered unreasonably radical, or and so the fact that she was an activist in AFW would have sort of painted the organization in some people's eyes, and that was true of Ruth Blyer also.
Mm-hmm.
I think the probably the lesbianism of some of the women also would have disturbed, at the time, would have disturbed some of the some women. So I think that quieter women would have, you know, been dissuaded from interacting with the organization. However, probably a larger factor was that, you know, those women who were in a tenure-track type of positions were, you know, extremely busy and stressed for time. And so, you know, always in these things, you know, most women don't make the time commitment.
Yeah. Now, apart from the Association of Faculty Women, do you know of any other ways that women got together on a formal or informal basis? And, you know, this might be like reading groups or consciousness-raising groups or weekly luncheons or Sigma Delta Epsilon.
Well, I think Sigma Delta Epsilon and such things did meet, and I remember getting announcements about them. And I know that, like, Helen Meyer, who was one of the research specialists in the department, like a senior scientist, I think she was involved with that, maybe Marion Meyer, who was initially a lecturer when I was there.
Mm-hmm.
But I did not go to that, but I remember getting announcements about it. I did learn that some graduate students were meeting in some kind of consciousness-raising group, and eventually I went, and Patricia Witt was the graduate student who got me involved in that, and she might have gotten me involved in the Association of Faculty Women, too, you know, that was very important to them, and I found it very interesting when I did go. And was very surprised because Patricia Witt and the other women, you know, like graduate students and postdocs and so on, who discussed things at these meetings, were very unhappy. They expressed a lot of unhappiness with their situation in graduate school or in labs in a postdoctoral capacity, feeling that they were, that the atmosphere was very uncongenial for a woman, and I was very surprised. One of the complaints they would make was that when there were research seminars, that the male researchers and students and so forth were showing off all the time, that there would be all these sort of questions and critiques and so on, but that they were not really sincere. They were mostly directed at, you know, showing off what a bright guy you were, and you know, pushing yourself ahead of others. And they found this, you know, revolting, and you know, didn't want to participate, and felt that they were being, the women felt that they were considered lesser beings because they didn't participate in this sort of pushy show-offiness. And
okay.
I really hadn't, you know, I mean, I went to many of these seminars they were talking about, and I didn't experience things that way, so I found it amazing and interesting that they did.
Maybe you could just clarify what exactly the term consciousness-raising group means, just to make sure, in case there are some listeners who don't know what that means.
Well, to me, it means people talking about their experiences and in particular settings, and then discovering that feelings that they had that they might not have made conscious to themselves, or might not have credited, thinking that only they were experiencing things this way, finding that many other women, if it's a women's consciousness raising group, many other people in the room have had the same experiences, and so by exchanging impressions, they are able to form their ideas more clearly and also gain strength and support mm-hmm. in the realization that they're not alone, and many people are suffering from the same factors.
Okay, so sort of a sense of gaining validation from hearing that other people might have had similar experiences.
Right, and also formulating your ideas by different people interacting and people bringing in different insights, and so being able to create a bigger picture out of it.
Okay, so once you became involved with this consciousness-raising group, is that something you continued to go to?
Irregularly, somewhat. But, of course, at the same time, you know, time was passing and more was being published about discrimination and the women's movement and patriarchy, and, you know, lectures were being given, and, you know, it got to be... of course, there was more discussion, and people's ideas developed. I don't think I would have been able to develop these ideas on my own, and I was quite astonished at what was developing, and it did make sense to me. You know, just that. I mean, of course, you know, Simone de Beauvoir published the Second Sex, and a whole lot of subsequent books commented on how women were second-class citizens and how, you know, this was part of a history of patriarchal societies and so forth. And, you know, this whole web of ideas gradually dawned on me, mm-hmm. you know, through the consciousness-raising groups and people recommending books to each other and so forth. I would not have encountered this kind of thing on my own. I was quite wrapped up in biology.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned books and speakers. Do you remember any, other than Simone de Beauvoir, do you remember any other particular speakers or books that circulated around campus and that were a really important source of ideas?
My problem is going to be that I don't know the dates, really. I mean, mm-hmm. a person, I eventually, through a group of women scientists at Wisconsin began meeting eventually, but I think that was in the 80s.
Okay.
And so I did quite a bit of reading in connection with that group. And I really don't remember exactly when that started, although I do remember that it resulted after a lecture given by Ruth Blyer, I think given at the women's... department, or there was a department of...
The Women's Studies Department,
perhaps.
Women's
Studies Department. Ruth Blyer gave a lecture, and I don't remember, I suppose it was the early 80s, but I don't remember exactly when, and this created a good deal of excitement, and a group of women decided they wanted to continue this in discussion groups that met regularly, and that group met regularly for a long time, and you know, would agree to read particular articles or books and discuss them. And these were primarily books about a feminist take on science and on scientific institutions and how women scientists were treated and this kind of thing. And you know, so for example, an author whose books were read a lot in that vein is Evelyn Fox Keller.
Mm-hmm.
But it may be that, I suppose that was more starting in the 80s, and we're back in the 70s now, so I don't remember back then.
Okay.
Which,
Okay. But it does sound like there was a lot of discussion, consciousness-raising groups. People were talking about these issues a lot.
Yes, but as far as I was fairly outside this, so for me, you know, not until sort of the end of the 70s.
Okay. Okay. I'm just going to turn off the tape recorder now. My name is Joyce Coleman, and I'm here again with Dr. Marian Namenworth. The date is April 10th, 2004, and we're going to continue the interview that we started 2 weeks ago. So, Dr. Niemannworth, I think you wanted to begin by amplifying on some comments you made last week about how women and men were socialized into different roles.
Yes. I found that when I actually began working as an assistant professor, that the way the research situation was structured, or the way the department was structured, and the expectations that senior department members had about how a junior faculty member would act, was related to a lot of the characteristics of men in our society, or what men are trained to do,
mm-hmm.
and didn't suit so well the way women were had been trained in our society, the way women are socialized from childhood to adulthood. And for example, women are or girls are encouraged and expected to be helpful and supportive, and not be particularly self-promoting,
mm-hmm.
and to do what needs to be done without making a lot of noise about it, and generally to help out and make the system work. That, you know, women are sustainers,
mm-hmm.
and they're rewarded for that. And that did affect me, too, in my upbringing, even though, as I mentioned before, my mother was a, you know, very leader-like person in the family and was very successful in business, working outside the home and all of that. So even though I never questioned that women are leaders and very bright and creative and so forth, I still thought of women also as doing what needs to be done to keep things going,
mm-hmm.
and not showboating about it. And I found, to my amazement, that in the department, when I agreed to do things that needed to be done, like serve on a lot of committees and do quite a lot of teaching, much more in both those categories than new or relatively new male faculty were doing,
mm-hmm.
I did it because I thought it was important, and that the rest of the faculty thought it was important, and that it would be considered positively and also acknowledged as taking up time and effort.
Mm-hmm.
And men tended to, the similarly situated young male faculty tended to try and teach as little as possible, did not serve on very many committees, and of course there was also the problem that there were only very, very few women faculty on tenure track at that time, you know, because
mm-hmm.
we were breaking ground there. I was the only tenure track woman faculty member in the department for the first few years I was there,
mm-hmm.
and so there was this artificial pressure to get women on every conceivable university and department committee so that it would look as though women were participating in the governance of the university. And also, of course, you know, for example, I served on admissions committees and hiring committees.
Mm.
There was a desire to have women's voices heard, or at least to perceive that it would be perceived that one was doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I agreed to a lot of this, but of course it took up a lot of time, and it turned out that, first of all, I found one problem with doing administrative work and teaching is that it takes time from your research, and there came a time approximately my fourth year of on the faculty where I was supposed to have a semester off from teaching. And then at the last minute, the department chairman at the time came and asked if I would teach a large course anyway, because there just wasn't another faculty member available at that time,
mm-hmm.
who could fill the slot easily. And I uncharacteristically said, I really wish you wouldn't ask me to do that, because, I'm going to come up for tenure soon. I need the time for research. I've been doing much more teaching than other young faculty and so forth. And the chairman at the time, I think Dr. Burns, did agree and back off and say, okay. But I found out later that this was not taken well by other department members,
mm-hmm.
or by some other department members. And it made me feel uncomfortable that I had declined, although I felt it was the right thing to do. But I think looking back on it that they wouldn't even have asked a young male faculty member to do that because they would have been more respectful of their need to have time for research.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, you know, the teaching loads of the male faculty were considerably less than what I was expected to do. So that's an example of how expectations for women, which were sort of sociological and related to the way women and men are raised in Western society, fed into a disparity between the way women and men were treated. I mean,
mm-hmm.
they gave me more teaching and administrative work to do than men. They expected me to do it. They didn't like it if I declined. I felt that I should do it because of the way I'd been socialized. But then when it came time to evaluate me for tenure, they did not really value that I did this teaching and administration beyond what others were asked to do, and you know, faulted me for and not having generated enough research based articles. So that would be an example of how society's expectations and the way girls and boys are socialized or were socialized at that time created a difference between the way male and female young faculty were treated at the university.
Okay. Now, maybe we could talk a little bit more about your research. Now, can you talk about the funding you were given and whether the facilities you were given were adequate for your research?
Yes. In fact, I had magnificent facilities because I moved into the lab that had recently been vacated by Dr. Kurland, who had just left the university before I came. He was a molecular biologist and had had enormous facilities certainly for a new faculty member. So in that sense, I walked into an excellent situation. Also, the University of Wisconsin at the time and probably still was very generous, or let's say very able, to support to contribute internal setup funds for new science faculty. And so the, you know, package of equipment and space and money that I got to set up the lab and get going was just excellent, and it was a strong component of my choosing to come to Wisconsin rather than go somewhere else to begin a career.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so it was just time that was the problem then.
Excuse me?
It was just time that was the problem. You were given sufficient facilities
it was only time. And then, of course, I, you know, applied for research grants after I came and, you know, was funded by NSF and so forth.
Okay.
In fact, that became a problem later, though, because I was so short of time and distracted by other tasks, I, you know, although I got, you know, research grants, and worked on them around the fourth or fifth year of my being on the faculty, I needed to reapply for grants, and I fell behind in the effort to reapply, and so, you know, that then created a more difficult situation when I came up for tenure because I, you know, had not yet had a second round of grants approved.
Okay.
And the department, as it would have been typical for a research-oriented university, considered the quantity of grants that you bring in very important. And, you know, I didn't fully take that on board.
Okay.
You know, I was thinking more in terms of quality of research and maybe quantity of research rather than dollars brought in. I think that created problems when I was considered for tenure.
Okay. And what research projects were you working on here?
Well, primarily I began working on an effort to study how molecules, particularly proteins and to some extent RNA molecules, are spatially localized in eggs before they begin developing, and I was using frog eggs as the example. Mm-hmm. And so I had developed a method of dividing the different regions of the frog egg into different test tubes, so to speak, by freezing the eggs and using a microtome to slice them, a cryostat mm-hmm. microtome to slice them. And then we were doing essentially biochemical experiments on the different fractions, and the basic idea was to try and identify molecules that were important, particularly proteins, that were important in initiating the development of eggs, in molecules important in starting the differentiation of the different regions of the egg by identifying them because they might have been spatially localized in particular regions. So the idea was, if you have molecules A, B, C, D, and E, if you find that molecule C is very much concentrated in the area where the brain is going to form, that would suggest that you should study molecule C a little more to see whether it might not have an important role in initiating brain development.
Okay.
So these were experiments on the molecules that are responsible potentially for initiating the first steps of development. So that was the main focus of the lab, in a way. But I was also, at least in terms of the graduate students, some of the graduate students working in my lab, I was continuing along the line of my own graduate research, which was on limb regeneration in salamanders.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly one of the master students in my lab did considerable research on how cells specialize during limb regeneration in salamanders, and particularly on the question of to what extent can cells that have specialized to become a certain type of tissue, for example, muscle cells or cartilage cells, to what extent can they divide and then give rise to cells that specialize in a different direction during the course of limb regeneration, or is the specialization so firm and irreversible that all the progeny of a muscle cell can only differentiate as muscle cells?
Hmm.
I had worked on that question for my PhD, and there were further sub-questions that evolved from that, and so that was continued by a graduate student in the lab also.
Okay.
So there were those two areas.
Okay. Now, perhaps you've talked a little bit about teaching already and how you had a heavy teaching load. Do you remember what classes you taught?
Well, the major task was to teach an introductory course that was intended for students who were not going to major in biology,
mm-hmm.
and or at least that was their initial idea. Some of them changed their minds once they were in the course, but it was a course that, you know, a science and society type course that it was called something like Biological Principles and Their Impact on Society.
Okay.
And I taught that one semester each year, and the course had an enrollment limited to something like 200 students,
mm-hmm.
and it was both lecture and lab, and of course they were subdivided into many labs, and so there were teaching assistants, and it was, a lecture with a couple of hundred students, which met, I think, three times a week, and you know, plus the lab. And so that I taught that one semester of each year. I think that there was one year where I might have taught it both semesters. And then the other semester, I would teach part of, I would like co-teach a graduate seminar
mm-hmm.
with another faculty member. And I was contributing maybe 2 weeks or so of, about 2 weeks of material, I think both lectures and labs, to the undergraduate developmental biology course.
Mm-hmm.
And this teaching teaching load was quite a bit, even though it was modest compared to some other departments. The usual teaching load in the zoology department at the time was quite a bit less than that. And one way in which it was less was that, let's say, for the other developmental biology faculty, and for example, Jack Lillian at the time when I came was a junior faculty member, not yet tenured in the developmental biology area. I think the heaviest part of his teaching load was to co-teach the developmental biology undergraduate course. So mm-hmm. I don't know what the enrollment might have been. Maybe, you know, it might have been 100 students or something in both lectures and labs. But, you know, several people together taught that course, so that he would have been responsible for only, you know, a third of, let's say, of the lectures and labs mm-hmm. in that course. And then, you know, there would be a, you know, graduate seminar or something, or part of a graduate seminar the other semester. So that would be an example of the difference in teaching loads in the department.
Okay. Now, this large lecture course you were teaching for non-science students, would that have been considered a very undesirable course to teach for their faculty? I'm wondering if they would have preferred to teach the science majors or the graduate students. And did that sort of shift the burden?
No, some of the faculty in the department were very good teachers, or at least at times in their careers, they were very good teachers. This would kind of wax and wane, because sometimes they would, you know, some of them would get preoccupied with other things, and they weren't so good, but they had the reputation of having been, you know, really very magnetic, you know, and fascinating teachers. So I think it is true that they would, it was more prestigious to teach and more desirable for a biologist to teach potential majors, but I wouldn't say it, I guess it's true, but I want to say that in the department, there, even among the most excellent and successful research faculty, there were some faculty who were also excellent teachers. Mm-hmm. You know, one who was really, you know, outstanding in that area was Dr. Crow, who actually was jointly appointed in zoology and genetics.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess his name was James Crow.
Yes.
And he was, you know, an excellent human geneticist with a, you know, very fine and deserved research reputation, and also a totally excellent teacher. And he certainly gave a lot of public lectures, and I invited him to give guest lectures in my introductory course. Whether he had it, you know, whether he would have taken on teaching a whole course of that kind, I don't know, but he certainly would have been great at it.
Okay, so it does sound like teaching was valued in the department then, and
not in the tenure evaluation, I would say, because those faculty who did minimal teaching and or who were not particularly good at it, you know, did not seem to be seriously faulted for it. There was a young male faculty member who was a, you know, sort of being considered for tenure in the, you know, maybe I think right before me, and you know, he was a slightly shy sort of person, I guess, and just didn't do well with large numbers of students, and you know, they went ahead, you know, they. It was so typical. I mean, the department was very empathetic with him, and you know, they liked him, and I liked him, and he, you know, was good at research, and he was good in small group discussions, and so they just said, well, you know, he just doesn't do well in larger classes, and you know, they overlooked the fact that he had done very little teaching, and that he signed up for a reasonable amount of teaching only the year before he was coming up for tenure, which mm-hmm. I found totally embarrassing, and you know, like, how, why would he embarrass himself that way, in the sense of to do something so obviously manipulative mm-hmm. in terms of his tenure consideration, which was coming up. But the department just loved it. I mean, they thought it was just fine, and they, you know, so in that sense, I don't think that that the valuing of quality teaching really existed where it counted.
You okay.
I mean, they would give lip service to it, and I think that people did admire each other for the extent to which they were really good teachers, but they certainly weren't interested in, they weren't going to credit it compared to research at all.
Okay. Did you enjoy teaching?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay. Now, we've been mentioning the tenure process, and maybe now we can talk specifically about it. What were your expectations? What did you know about the tenure process when you first arrived at UW?
Well, I think when I arrived, I knew very little about it, except what it was, that they would make a judgment after you'd been there a few years about whether you could be tenured and that it was necessary to get tenure to stay at a university. But then I lucked into the situation, which I'm sure was very unusual, that the department around the time that I came or the year before I came or something like that had voted that non-tenured faculty could sit in on the deliberations for tenure of other faculty.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that had been done so that faculty would have some idea of what it was all about before they came up for tenure themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And although I really don't know what led to that decision. And so in the first few years that I was in the department, I sat in on at least two proceedings for, faculty discussions. I mean, I wasn't there by the time they were voting, but the early rounds of discussions mm-hmm. about whether somebody merited tenure, which took place in a faculty meeting. And that was very informative, because I, of course, I knew these faculty and knew a little about their research or more in the case of people close to my area. And then I would listen to the faculty evaluate this work and, saw the way it was presented. For example, that there was a particular faculty member assigned to promote and defend the promotion of each candidate
mm-hmm.
so that there would be a sort of, lawyer, so to speak, for an advocate
okay.
for the candidate who would present the work and defend it against the probes and, questioning
mm-hmm.
by the other faculty. And I developed a sense of how the faculty were quite considerate and searching in evaluating the candidate and realized that different individuals develop challenges. The challenge might be grant funding, or it might be that they were being distracted by something that happened in their private lives or that their personalities were creating problems in this area and strength in this area. And I was quite struck by how generous the department seemed to be in their evaluations. And in fact, they went ahead and granted enthusiastically, voted for tenure for every other faculty member in the department. So I sat in on at least two, maybe even three of these considerations.
Okay.
And probably only two.
Okay.
I think somewhere during the time I was there, they might have stopped that system so non-tenured faculty couldn't go anymore to those discussions. But anyway, I got an idea of what it would be like, but it turned out that it was totally misleading because when it came to my turn, they didn't seem to operate that way at all.
Okay. Were you given feedback every few years about how you were doing and how people felt about your work?
Hardly at all. And this was a problem. I think this task was probably assigned to the chairman of the department, and the chairman during much of my time there was a kind of shy person, or at least a person who didn't feel comfortable going to another faculty member, and particularly a woman faculty member, and telling her that this and that was a worry to the department or something like that. So I got very little feedback, and looking back on it, I should have corralled people and asked them how I was doing and how what I needed to worry about or change, and I didn't do that, and it was not that I couldn't talk to people. I mean, people were definitely friendly, and I, you know, it's easy for me to think of who I could have gone to, but I didn't realize that there were, you know, so that I needed to find that out. You know, I thought it was obvious to me what my strengths and weaknesses were, but on the other hand, I expected them to be evaluated along the lines that I saw them evaluating the men who were considered before me, and that didn't happen. Mm-hmm. So, but I didn't realize that until it was too late.
Okay. So there was no one in the department who was sort of like a mentor to you?
No, and I think that, I don't know to what extent that was supposed to, I guess it was supposed to be happening. I don't know. I don't know who it would have been. There were three other developmental biology faculty, one of whom was an assistant professor when I first came, and then was promoted, and the other two were already tenured faculty when I came. And if one of them was supposed to be my mentor, I don't know. In any case, I don't recall any particular time of being taken aside and told to do this or that, or even, you know, to being evaluated by them or anything like that. I talk to them on a daily basis, but we never had a session like that, unless I'm forgetting something.
Okay. Now, what year did you come up for tenure?
I asked to not be considered, I think, until my sixth year, because at that time, you know, I was hoping to reapply for grants, and especially I had a lot of research data that hadn't been published yet, and I, you know, felt it was important to get that stuff accepted in journals and so forth, and that had happened to considerable extent by my sixth year, so I think they would have considered me in my fourth or fifth year. But if I remember, I know I asked them to postpone the consideration, and I think that meant that it was my sixth year when I was considered, but I could be wrong.
Okay. And tell me a little bit about what happened then when you asked to be considered for tenure.
Well, it was automatic. You don't ask. I mean...
Okay.
So I have to say that I don't remember I was asked to submit some documentation like a vita and you know, a publication list and, you know, a list of the teaching I'd done and that kind of thing. But I don't remember any other kind of preparation. I don't remember meeting with any particular person or being aware that a particular person was in charge of the of presenting my case or something like that. Mm-hmm. I will have to put the proviso in here continually that it's possible that I'm just not remembering this completely, but I don't recall being aware of any particular person as the go-to person to consider, to ask about how things were going and mm-hmm. what else was needed and so forth.
Okay.
Other than maybe the chairman of the department, who I think was again then William Burns. Dr. Abramson had been chairman for a few years, and I think then perhaps Dr. Burns was chairman again.
Okay. Okay, well then when did you first hear the news that your tenure application was then turned down?
What happened was that there was a virtually split vote in the department, you know, with, I don't remember how many department members there were, but let's say, you know, it was like a 12-11 vote or something like that.
Okay.
In favor of tenure. The procedure is to then the recommendation for tenure and the vote and the documentation and so forth is put together and sent to the divisional committee, the Biological Sciences Committee, which includes faculty members of different departments
mm-hmm.
and is chaired by a dean, I believe, and then that they decide whether to follow the department's so-called recommendation. I say so-called in this case since it was a split,
mm-hmm.
or to turn it down. And
okay.
And so it was turned down at the divisional committee level, but it was clear to me that this was because of the very divided opinion in the department, and also because, and I suspected that probably individuals who were, you know, were against my promotion had talked to divisional committee members and encouraged them to turn it down.
Okay.
I don't know whether that's the case, but I presume it's the case.
Okay. And how did you react to the news?
Well, I was surprised and amazed and thought that it wouldn't stand. And, you know, because I felt that it was way out of line with the decisions that had been made on my predecessors. In other words, I felt that the sum total of research, teaching and administration, or let's say just research and teaching and administration, really wasn't valued. That the sum total of research and teaching that I had done was clearly within the same ballpark as that of several male faculty members that they had promoted during the time that I was there. And in fact, they hadn't turned anybody down at all. You know, they had promoted each one that came up. And so I felt that, you know, they didn't have a leg to stand on, and that if I, you know, if I documented in a comparative way what I had done versus what others in the department who were promoted had done, then the divisional committee would realize that this was way out of line and would, you know, reverse their decision. And so I put together a comparative document, you know, comparing the research and publications and teaching loads of the several males who had been promoted to tenure in the preceding 5 years, compared that, and I think I even included the person considered right after me who was also, the following year, who was also promoted, and, you know, compared that to my publications, research and teaching, and, you know, this, you know, sent it to the divisional committee, and, you know, of course, people in the department saw it, and so there was sort of turmoil about it for quite a while, but, you know, they just reaffirmed their old position, although they did give me an extra year to, you know, to be on the faculty. I think I must have been there 8 years altogether because of that. But as a result, I ended up filing a sex discrimination complaint with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission and the Labor Department, and ended up suing the university under Title VII of the, I guess it's the Civil Rights Act, I don't know, but, you know, the law against, that had been passed against discrimination.
Okay.
In employment.
Okay. Now, and just to clarify, when you said they let you stay for an extra year, that was the divisional committee that allowed you to stay?
Well, I suppose, I don't know, the chancellor or the whoever makes that decision, you know, it's made at the top of the administration. But, you know, undoubtedly it was an effort by the, you know, with the advice of the legal advisors of the university to sort of provide something to compensate me or to discourage me from, you know, suing the university.
Okay, so this was not an extra year in which you could try to perhaps accomplish more research and gain tenure. This was one more year with the understanding that you still would not be given tenure at the end.
Yes, by the eighth year, yeah.
Okay.
Whether there was another consideration after the sixth year, I don't, you know, like in the seventh year, I don't think so. I don't remember it, but I don't think so.
Okay. Now, meanwhile, how were other women on campus reacting? I mean, did you find support among other women for your case?
Oh, yeah, in, you know, like with the Association of Faculty Women and so on. Yeah, definitely.
Okay. Now, can you tell me a bit more about your lawsuit against the university and how that went?
Well, the procedure at the time, anyway, was that under Title VII, you needed to file with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. They would handle it, and also some maybe through EEOC or indirectly, the Labor Department became involved, the U.S. Labor Department. So at the time, EEOC was swamped, and so you were required to file with them, but they were actually dealing with only a very tiny fraction of the cases, submitted. So the legalism was that after they had the case for at least 6 months or something like that, then you could go forward with a lawsuit. They would have to allow you to go forward with a lawsuit even if they hadn't had the chance to investigate it themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way it went. I don't remember any signs that they really investigated it, but I don't know for sure. The Labor Department did investigate it. They sent people to interview me and others and looked at the documentation and so forth, and they found in my favor. I mean, they said that it looked as though that this was unequal treatment and so forth, but I just went ahead with the lawsuit. I mean, the Labor Department, you know, it was not in the position of bringing lawsuits.
Okay.
I don't think they did that. So, you know, that they, I guess, filed a report, you know, to tell the university what they thought. But meanwhile, I had hired a lawyer and went ahead with a Title VII discrimination suit. And I did expect that that the university would just back off and reconsider, because I didn't think that this, you know, I thought on its face that they had a losing case.
Mm-hmm.
And even though I realized that it was difficult to win, you know, because other people were filing these lawsuits at other universities, excuse me. But we went ahead with the lawsuit, and you know, I know, I was expecting the university would, you know, cave, that it would, you know, might not actually go to trial.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, you know, as it got closer to trial, there were some feelers put out about settlement amounts and so on. But I had, you know, made it clear to my lawyer and he to them that, you know, I wasn't interested in the settlement, that I just was interested in, you know, continuing my job at the university.
Okay,
So we did go to trial.
Okay. Now, did that involve you testifying and members of the zoology department testifying?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, it did.
And what was the final result of the lawsuit?
The result of the lawsuit was that we lost. There was, let's see, this was a lawsuit in front of a judge, and in fact, in front of a magistrate. Excuse me, I need to cough for a minute.
Oh, of course.
And I'm going
to... I'll just pause.
Something, huh?
Okay, we're back again.
This lawsuit was in front of a magistrate, and we had agreed to this person, the magistrate being in the acting as judge in the case. He was known to, you know, of course, the local legal people, and I was advised that he was a fair person.
Mm-hmm.
Now, during, you know, towards the end of the trial, he called us into a conference with him. Can we go back to pause for a minute?
Yes. Now, we're going to resume our conversation. You were just talking about a meeting with the magistrate.
Right. The magistrate called us, both lawyers, into his chambers and said that he had just accepted a job offer. I believe it... I think it was working in the Attorney General's office, in the office of the State Attorney General. And this meant that he would be working for the prosecutor of the case, or for the state attorney. In other words, the state, I don't remember the exact legal structure here, but the university was being defended. Since I had sued the university and it's a state university, the university was being defended by the state of Wisconsin Attorney General's office.
Mm-hmm.
So the magistrate, who was the judge in the trial, had just agreed, had been offered a job in that entity.
Okay.
And had accepted it. So, you know, he was asking us, so do you want to, you know, have me end the trial and start all over again, because, you know, you might consider me not a neutral party now,
mm-hmm.
or do you want to continue with the trial? And so, you know, my lawyer and I discussed it, and because this man had the reputation of being honest, and that, you know, I think my lawyer sort of knew him or knew people who had worked with him and so forth, since Madison's not that big a place. You know, we felt on balance, you know, since it would be inordinately expensive and time-consuming to start all over again, mm-hmm. since this was fairly close to the end, we decided to say, okay, you know, why don't you just continue? And, you know, whether this was a good decision, I don't know. But anyway, he ended up, you know, ruling against us in a, you know, fairly mealy-mouthed way. And then, you know, as far as the content of this decision, mm-hmm. The verbal content of the decision, which took a long, long, long time in coming. And then we appealed this to the circuit court for the Seventh Circuit. And there we lost on a 2-1 decision. There were 3 judges.
Mm-hmm.
And the tenor of the majority's decision, I mean, you know, the way they explained their decision, was to say that tenure matters were not things that could be second-guessed by judges, because when evaluating research and teaching and so forth, this is something that experts must do, and that the faculty were the experts, and the judges were not in a position to second-guess what the experts had decided.
Okay.
So they were essentially saying that courts couldn't be used to question decisions by faculty members,
mm-hmm.
and or that it Posner was one of the judges, and he, you know, his a guideline to his attitudes about the law was that there were certain things which it wasn't efficient to do, and might be desirable, but it just wasn't realistic, and made the system inefficient if you let courts get into certain areas that they, you know, really didn't function well in. So,
mm-hmm.
and I think he was a leading energy behind that sort of attitude. So, you know, so of the 3 judges, 1 voted in our favor, and he and 1 other voted against.
Okay. Now, this would have, how would, for example, the Association of University Faculty, of Women Faculty, respond to this? Because this would really remove a lot of power from people who felt that they had been discriminated against.
Well, the Association of Faculty Women was very strongly backing me, and there was fundraising to try and raise funds to cover some of the expenses of this, and they were very supportive. Ruth Blyer was one of, you know, very energetic mm-hmm. person mobilizing forces to help, and so by the time it was at the appeals court level, and I guess before also, there was a lot of support, and you know, there were articles in the student paper and to informed of what was going on, and mm-hmm. there was a kind of movement of people to back me, and I suppose there were letters written and that kind of thing. Certainly within the university there were, whether briefs were filed with the court, I don't know. Some people testified at the trial level on my behalf, and
would these have been your students or other women or faculty members?
Well, first of all, of course, the zoology department members were called to testify, but students were students. You know, in small numbers, were called to testify, and I honestly can't remember whether other women on women faculty on campus. I mean, there were no women from the zoology department
mm-hmm.
testified, as far as I remember. There were none on tenure track for most of the time I was there, and I guess, let's say, there was another 1 or 2 assistant professors by the time that I was turned down for tenure, but they were junior faculty, and it would
mm-hmm.
have been, they would have been put in a horrible position.
And yes.
So they, you know, there were no senior women to testify in the zoology department, and I honestly can't remember whether other women, you know, like tenured faculty. Even Ruth Blyer, I honestly can't remember whether she testified. It would have been a stretch, I think, sort of, you know, since these women from other departments wouldn't have really been in my research area or anything like that.
Yeah, okay. Now, when the final appeal was turned down, what did you do next?
Well, a lot of time elapsed. I mean, by the time at the appeals court level, I mean, that only happened in 1984. By that time, I had moved to the Twin Cities and doing research at the University of Minnesota and so forth.
Okay.
But I did stay around Madison for a couple of extra years at least. I was on the, you know, since I stayed on the faculty for 8 years, that extended to 1979, and then I was working on the court case, helping my lawyer prepare for it and so on, and I did interviews on WORT radio and that kind of thing for a while, but then at the beginning of 82, I moved to St. Paul and began working as a research associate in the genetics department at the University of Minnesota.
Okay. Now,
but I would go back and forth a lot, and of course there was the appeals process that was developing and that we had to prepare for and so forth.
Okay, and what finally happened in 1984 when you received news that it had been turned down?
Well, I just continued my life in the Twin Cities. I certainly, if I had won, I would have.
Okay, sorry. Please continue.
When I realized that, the appeals court effort had failed and, you know, that I wasn't going to get to go back to my position at the University of Wisconsin, I just continued my life in Minnesota, which consisted of a series of occasions to do research, and then I did some teaching at the University of Minnesota as an adjunct faculty member, not on tenure track, occasionally teaching genetics or cell biology when other faculty weren't available to do it. And also, after a while, I began teaching on year-to-year contracts as a visiting assistant professor at McAllister College, and taught a variety of biology-type courses, genetics and developmental biology and cell and molecular biology, and also some feminist-oriented courses, like feminist perspectives on science-type courses, all at the at McAllister College.
Okay.
And now I've gone back to research. I'm working in the medical school at the University of Minnesota.
Okay. Now, you mentioned teaching some courses on feminism, and I wanted to ask you about your 1985 article called Science Through a Feminist Prism. And when I looked this article up on Google, it seemed like it had been assigned in many women's studies courses, so it's quite a popular article to assign. First of all, I wanted to ask, in the acknowledgments to this article, you mention a Women in Science reading group, a Women in Science study group at UW. And I think you talked a little bit about it last time. It was a group that was inspired by a talk given by Ruth Blyer. Can you recall any details about this group? And I'm also interested to know a bit more about Ruth Blyer and her role in it.
Yes. Well, as I mentioned, this group formed at the end of a lecture given by Ruth Blyer about feminist perspectives on science, and it really excited people. Ruth wasn't very inspiring person and an excellent lecturer and excellent scientist and so forth. And so people were so excited by her ideas that they asked her whether we could form a discussion group around these topics, and it became known as the, somewhat tongue-in-cheek, as the October 29th group, because it was October 29th was the date of Ruth's talk. And we began meeting every few weeks, and would these were all women scientists at various levels in the university, you know, some faculty and research associates and people in various kinds of scientific positions.
Mm-hmm.
And we would generally agree to read some article or part of a book in preparation for the discussion, and then orient our discussions around that reading that we had done. And I remember it vividly because it has continued until practically now. Of course, in the first years, it often was at Ruth Blyer's house, or she certainly even when it wasn't, she participated in these discussions and was a mainstay of the group.
Mm-hmm.
After her, you know, totally unfortunate, horrible death, we continued, and we have continued practically to this day, although about a year ago we decided it was getting too difficult to find times when all of us could meet, because in the interim, you know, a lot of participants had left town and moved to jobs elsewhere, and some of these people can come. Of course, I was one of them, because I've been living in the Twin Cities, but I was going down to Madison, you know, every month or two anyway, and then also, some people had taken jobs in Milwaukee and so on, but even so, we were finding our way back to Madison for these meetings and got a lot of energy and insight from it. I certainly did. I mean, I wasn't concerned or thinking about feminism in relation to science, you know, while I was on the faculty, you know, very much. I didn't, you know, I guess not getting tenure was a big impetus to start thinking about these things. But anyway, I certainly found these perspectives very thought-provoking and, you know, was interesting reading about these things. And it was also, just as with the Association of Faculty Women itself, it was exciting to be friends with other women from other disciplines who, you know, were in, had similar concerns and interests as I did. And so the group gradually became, you know, a combination, friends meeting to talk about stuff, and, you know, a serious discussion group about the feminist critique of science. And I have found it very, very interesting, and I think others did too, and we've kept it up. You know, many of our former members are, you know, on the East Coast or the West Coast, or there's one who's been working in British Columbia, and so we, you know, we certainly only a small group of members remaining near Madison are able to get back for any discussions now.
Okay. Can you tell me a bit more about Ruth Blyer? She's come up several times in conversation now, and can you just tell me, perhaps just describe her role on campus and what you think she did for women on campus?
Yes. Ruth Blyer was a very intelligent, very energetic, and magnetic person, and she had a lot of impact. She was a very driven person, a person who wanted to right all wrongs and make the world, you know, shake the world and make it be the way it's supposed to be. And I don't think she had any doubt about the way it's supposed to be and that it wasn't meeting her expectations.
Mm-hmm.
So on the one hand, she was very driven. She was very tough on herself and had very high standards for herself as a researcher in neurobiology, so she put a lot of energy and concentration into her work as a scientist, and she was definitely very successful and, you know, productive and, you know, did excellent work. But at the same time, she put a lot of energy and determination into helping the downtrodden. I mean, I was one of the downtrodden when I was, getting shafted in the tenure process, but there were various conflicts in which women got the short end of the stick, and Ruth was determined to do everything that was possible in order to improve the situation, and she was quite fearless and bursting with energy, and so she became a real leader in the Association of Faculty Women and into driving that association to organize around issues and herself, putting herself on the front line in organizing protests, whether written or whether involving marching or running or whatever. And so she, and also being a really fascinating person from my point of view, I presume other people found that too. You know, she could be a leader, you know, because she had the energy and she had the ideas, and people really loved her. They looked to her, they admired her, and so she was very important.
And now, she edited this volume in which your essay was published. Was this the only essay you wrote on the topic, or do you have other essays on the topic of feminism?
No, I think this is the only real essay. I think I might have given a talk or two, but this is the... well, maybe there was... I know. Our group wrote an analysis a couple of years after this, so I was just one author of in the whole group of that.
Okay.
But this one, I think, was the only one I wrote on my own, sort of.
Okay. And in what ways was this article informed by your experience at UW?
Oh, absolutely. You know, you mentioned it to me, and I went back and read it when I hadn't read it or even thought about it for, you know, many years. So, yeah, it was very practically oriented. You know, it was really my emoting or declaring my surprise at the way things were organized in science as I had experienced them, you know, being a junior faculty member at Wisconsin, you know, and being surprised by the way it contrasts to what I expected. And, I mean, of course, it wasn't all new. I had been a graduate student and a postdoc, and to some extent had seen how things work. But I was really surprised by the degree to which the basic values of science, to some extent, took a back seat manipulating to make yourself look better than what you were really are, than what you were really doing. By, for example, I'll give just to give a little example, it was a totally common practice to multiply the number of publications that one had to one's credit by writing very repetitious publications in which each title included a sliver of new information,
mm-hmm.
Enhanced with a whole lot of information that had been published elsewhere. So if you worked on something for a couple of years and could easily have described it in a very good article, that was not an advisable thing to do. The idea was to make 5 or 8 articles out of it, and so that there would be a lot of titles. Now, this seemed to me so silly and counterproductive and bogus that I assumed that everybody would recognize what was going on and would devalue it. But in fact, what I saw was that this was expected, and it was demanded.
Hmm.
And if you were, if you just wrote one excellent article, this would be counted against you because, somebody else had written, less material in 5 articles. So there were lots of things like that. There were lots of ways in which form and manipulation were credited when they should really have been laughed at or disparaged. And that surprised me, and it seemed to kind of distort what was happening and, that kind of thing.
Okay. One other thing you mentioned in the article is that at various times certain research methods are considered trendy, and
yeah,
it's important
right.
to incorporate them, and that, there's a certain trendiness, and if you're doing more old-fashioned work or you're sort of outside of those trends, your work isn't considered as important.
I saw that happen, and I found it amazing that people, meaning my faculty colleagues, who were intelligent and, seemed to me, that they should be able to see straight about these things, would just go ahead and, you know, follow along with these ideas, with these trends. And, you know, it seemed like a shame. But, you know, that's really the way things were. One thing that, this is not exactly relevant, but I would add it to the situation that I found myself in when I was coming up for tenure. As I described, there was an area of research work that was quite new. And in fact, you know, time has shown that that area was then became very important in subsequent years in my field, developmental biology. Anyway, this had to do with studying the spatial localization of molecules in different parts of frog eggs. This was a new area and for me. And when it was evaluated at tenure time, the feedback I got about it later was that the faculty were worried about this because they, you know, this was different from what other people had been doing, and, you know, although it looked like a good idea, where was this going to go, and how could they have confidence in it, and they didn't know what the future would bring, and so forth. Okay, then there was the area of limb regeneration, which was following up on work I had done as a graduate student and under my mentor, who was a famous biologist. And so there the feedback was, I found out later, well, this is good and we know that it's productive, and but, you know, maybe this is just her mentor's ideas. You know, we can't really credit her with this because, you know, she brought this with her from mm-hmm. graduate school. So it seemed that I couldn't win. You mm-hmm. know, if I went in a new direction, they were worried about, well, where is this going to go? And if I pursued older directions, then
it wasn't
I couldn't
original.
Really get credit for it.
Yeah, it wasn't.
You know, and this is an example of how much of a contrast there was between the way my work was evaluated and that of males. And I think this is an example also of how unconscious prejudice works.
Mm-hmm.
I think that because I was a woman, it was hard for them to have confidence in what I was doing. And so that then created this sort of conundrum about, you know, we can't trust her with new work and we can't credit her for old work.
Mm, okay. Now, when reading your article, I know that some feminists, and I'm not sure if that's still true, but at one point were almost on the point of discouraging women from entering science, the sort of hopelessness about science. Well, it's sort of, it's hopelessly male, and so women should pursue other areas. It seemed like in this article you took a different approach and you still wanted to encourage women to pursue science. Is that correct?
Oh, absolutely. And I must say that I was not aware that feminists were discouraging women from going into science. I mean, in my experience, the most serious critics of the male science establishment would have said, don't join the establishment, women. Make your own science. You know, be pioneers in a feminist science. I really didn't come in contact with people who were saying leave science to the men and
okay.
become artists or something like that.
Okay.
Definitely, I mean, anyway, it wouldn't matter if I told women not to go into science. I mean, women there have always been women who were really drawn to science and found it fascinating and did great work in it. The problem has been, you know, getting credit and getting into the institutions. And in fact, things are not quite as bad as I think as they were, you know, 20 years ago. I mean, there are more women in the science establishment now, and of course, that doesn't mean they have free rein to do things exactly the way they want to. And women also come under the influence of these trends that beset men, but or that are more part of male culture. But you know, things evolve, and yeah, science is a very fertile field for women.
Now, you say that things have improved. To what do you attribute these improvements?
I think, you know, the evolution of society. I mean, the position of women has changed enormously. My mother, who was very self-confident and aggressive and successful, was tortured by guilt because she wasn't at home as a housekeeper, as a homemaker. And, you know, I mean, the... As I think we spoke about before, the human mind can hold a lot of contradictory beliefs and act on all of them. And, you know, my mother wanted to go out in the world and earn a living and, you know, do something interesting and so forth. And she did, and she was great at it, and she knew she was. But she also berated herself for not being the homemaker that was featured on television in the 50s. And, you know, I forgot why. Where am I going with this? What you asked me?
But the evolution of women's roles.
Right, so society evolves, and now, for example, you know, there's much more acknowledgement by society that women have ambitions and creativity, and they should be able to have careers and, you know, the way men do, and that society should adjust to that, and in the university that, you know, faculties and administrators have become much more aware, first of all, that women are very productive and important in these fields, and that they have a right to the same careers under the same conditions as men. And also, administrators and faculty have become much more aware of hidden forms of discrimination.
Mm-hmm.
I, you know, when I accused the zoology department of discrimination in my tenure process, they were absolutely outraged, because discrimination is sort of the opposite of objectivity, and they as scientists, they considered themselves to be totally objective and beyond the possibility of prejudice.
Mm-hmm.
Now, part of the problem here is that a lot of what was going on was not exactly intended. And, you know, I'm sure that nobody said even to themselves, let alone out loud, she's a woman, we don't want her on the faculty. I really don't think so, you know, even in the 70s. But there was a lot of less conscious prejudice, you know, because there were different expectations for what men do and what women do, and different expectations about behavior. I don't think that the male faculty realized how much their ideas about what a faculty member should be doing was associated with the way males are trained to behave, things which don't really help science particularly, but which, you know, are just part of men jockeying for position.
Okay.
And I think there were things they didn't realize. And also, the department had a history of having women working for them, not in tenured positions, but to do the supportive stuff in the department, you know, to handle the supplies and do the most basic teaching and do research in the laboratories headed by men. And they didn't realize that these expectations were still hooked to women who they allowed to, or were sort of goaded into putting on the tenure track faculty.
Okay. So how optimistic are you about the future of women in science?
Oh, I think that, you know, women will become a more important part of the scientific establishment. You know, there are going to continue to be conflicts, but I think that women will, just as in the rest of society, that women will have more important positions than they did 20, 30 years ago, will have a chance to influence things to a greater extent. But this sort of wrestling between different psychological tendencies is going to exist. And it's not just between men and women. You know, you see it in government, too. You have women in fairly high positions in government, but, of course, you know, many more men are at the top, and, you know, there are various aspects of society that make it easier for men to get to the top and give them more motivation to get to the top, and so they have more control about things. But it's not just women and men. I mean, men aren't all the same. Men have a diversity of characteristics, and we see in the United States now, you know, that they're at the moment we are held captive by a group of men who value war and conflict and dominance enormously, and not all the men are in the country are satisfied with this, but they have hold of things now, and, you know, there's a conflict about how long are they going to be in control of the country's programs, and I think that will exist in science, too, that there will be tendencies to keep science very authoritarian and structured in a top-down way, but, mm-hmm. you know, resistance to it, too, and I think that women will have a gradual influence on the way science is done, but, you know, I'm quite sure I'm not going to live to see science in the ideal way that I would like to see it.
Now, do you have any final comments you want to make about perhaps your career here or your career since you've been here?
No, I liked working at the University of Wisconsin a lot. I think it was at the time, certainly, and I presume, I think to a large extent still now, you know, a really excellent institution in the biomedical sciences with a very large research establishment. And also I liked very much the way it was organized. The administration was in general very supportive of the faculty, and I like Madison a lot. So I'm very sorry that things didn't work out, and I think I was, you know, sort of, I mean, on the one hand, I was very lucky to come out on the job market at a time when universities like Wisconsin were all of a sudden under pressure to hire women to the tenured faculty in science departments. So this outside influence gave me an access, it gave me job offers from a lot of places that might not have been so quick to offer me a job had it not been at this particular moment.
Mm-hmm.
Then, you know, 6 or 7 years later, I got axed because this process of opening the system to women was only partially successful by that moment. And so, I was one of the women who, lost out. But, you know, it's part of the ride.
Okay, well, thank you very much for your time. I greatly appreciate this, and this will be an important addition to our collection.
Well, thanks, Joyce. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Yes.